So we know a lot about how young people think, and I like how they think. I like the fact that they're geographically mercenary. That they say, you know what? I'm going to vote with my feet. I'm going to vote with my wallet. I'm going to vote with my sentiment online, with my clicks. And I'm going to physically or digitally go to places that reflect my values. And so places have to be accommodating of those values. They want affordable housing. They want a liberal culture. You know, they believe in mobility. They believe in sustainability. They believe in connectivity. They believe all of these things are human rights. And the world, our institutions, political, economic, social, have to literally redesign ourselves around those values. And those that don't will lose. And I want them to lose, and I want them to learn the hard way if they have to. But I want the winners to prosper, and I want those places to be the open places that attract and gain the talent without a moment's delay.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issue shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week, we're talking to best-selling writer and geostrategist Parag Khanna, someone I've had the pleasure of knowing for well over two decades. In that time, he's been an advisor to governments and business leaders at the highest levels globally. He's also been affiliated with the Brookings Institution, New America Foundation, and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, but to name a few. He regularly appears on CNN and in the New York Times, and has received many accolades. In fact, Esquire magazine named him one of the 75 most influential people of the 21st century. His books include Second World, Connectography, The Future is Asian, and his latest, Move. Today, we're here to discuss his latest book, Move, The Forces Uprooting Us, which focuses on the importance of mass migration and the trends leading up to it. According to Parag, the future will be defined by movement. We start our conversation on what motivated him to write this book and break down his thesis.
Great to see you.
Great to see you.
Let me just start with a question as to why did you write this book right now? How do you see the significance of the book in the context of the prior books and the lead up to it?
So one caveat, the phrase right now. So the funny thing is I finished this before the pandemic, but I was sort of a happy victim, you might say, of the global paper shortages, supply chain disruptions, and the general global lockdown that afflicted the world over the last 2 years. But that became a great leitmotif, you know, in a way. I mean, I sort of, you know, begin by saying, look, we are living through the most coordinated single act in the history of the human species, and it was a lockdown. And yet, if we can coordinate this, we can also coordinate the next great migration. And that's what the book was originally about anyway, the future of human geography, looking out 2030, 2040, 2050. What will be the distribution of humanity across the planet? Where will we be? Why did we get there? How did we get there over the next couple of decades? And the operative that word is then geography. As you know, that's my sort of heart and soul. And I wanted to write a sequel to Connectography. Connectography was about the functional geography of infrastructure, all of the connectivity that we build around the world. And this book was simply a sequel and to answer the question, well, now that we've built all this stuff, how are we going to use it? And so it's not actually a book only about the mobility of people. It's actually about the mobility of everything. It's bits and atoms, you might say, but obviously a bit an emphasis on atoms in particular, you know, carbon and, you know, biological atoms.
Take us through the thesis of the book for those who haven't read it.
So I argue that, you know, the human species has been nomadic for the past 100,000 years. And only in recent centuries have the majority of us settled into what we would call considered to be sedentary patterns. So, you know, give or take a few hundred years in either direction. But that due to a range of drivers and underlying forces, we are in some ways becoming nomadic again. And those forces, in terms of the historical thrust that they give to the movement of people, are things like labor imbalances, demographic imbalances. So the gap between old and young, Canada is affected by this, the United States, the entire OECD world has significant labor shortages because it's aging and fertility has crashed. That's within countries and across countries. And in the 20th century, that is far and away the largest driver of human migration. It's just the search for economic opportunity as people move towards geographies where their labor is needed. Think of Latinos and Asians coming to America in the post-war decades. Think of course, Turks in Germany and so on. That outnumbers the second driver, which is, of course, politics. The partition of India and Pakistan, genocides, World War II, expulsions. Add that all up, and yes, it's hundreds of millions of people, but it's less than the number of economic migrants, but it's very significant. So there I break it down between international conflicts, domestic conflicts, civil wars, all those kinds of things, just odious regimes, people fleeing and so forth. You know, there's issues like famine at the confluence of these two. There's a lot of overlap between these drivers. And then, you know, let me quickly, you know, go into the other three economic causes. And again, it could be economic collapse. Just look at the financial crisis of 2008. People in America move from the, you know, Rust Belt to the Sun Belt, Southern Europe to Northern Europe, you know, rural Chinese to urban China, you know, coastal China. Now, note those examples. Interestingly, most of those are domestic. And I just want a tiny caveat here because it's very important. Migration is not necessarily international. Right? It's the movement. This book is about the mobility of human beings and our relocation from point A to point B. It does not mean crossing an international border per se. A lot of it is that, but that is not the definition of what it means to move for the sake of a better life. Because in the example of China and India today, as you well know, simply moving from a rural area to an urban area is an absolutely existentially life-changing experience without ever having crossed a border. And I fully acknowledge that most human beings will never cross a border, in fact. And then anyway, technology is another factor. Your factory closes somewhere, you lose your job to automation, you have to move and live somewhere cheaper. Remote work is maybe a happy technological disruption, right? Now you can go and live anywhere, so people will move out of, you know, expensive cities towards cheaper rural areas, whatever the case may be. Digital natives will move, you know, from Los Angeles to Bali or Panama or whatever. So there's a lot of that going on. And the final factor, Rana, climate change. The original driver of human migration, rearing its ugly head again, 12,000 years since the retreat of the last ice age. In this century alone, in the last two decades alone, climate has accounted for more displacement of people and more migration than politics or economics. So in some ways, therefore, we're coming full circle as we return to the opposite of an ice age, but to climate as a driver of migration. We're going back to that period of history when we were nomadic. So there is something circular going on in a grand meta-historical, cosmological kind of way. And all of these factors, you know, drive each other. The climate relates to the economics, relates to the politics, relates to the demographics, and everything is pushing people to move. So I foresee a century in which you will have more than 1 billion people migrating and moving, perhaps 2 billion, which is significantly larger than previous centuries. But if you look at the last several centuries, we've gone from millions to 10 million, tens of millions to hundreds of millions of migrants, and now we're moving towards billions. You see the trend, the decimal point always moves to the right. And it's going to happen, it's absolutely inevitable. We should make the most of it and create a better model of human civilization, knowing what we know about what's going to happen next.
Prague explains to us different scenarios where the future is headed, both for Canadians and non-Canadians alike, and how these scenarios will impact Canada's future.
You take us through four different scenarios for the future. One of those scenarios is Northern Lights, which I'd like to get into in terms of Canada particularly. But take us through those scenarios, and what's your take on those scenarios?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because I wouldn't want to be accused of being overly blithe in the characterization of how we simply need to embrace what is going to be the most significant reorganization and resettlement of the human population that's ever happened. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And in the book, I have four scenarios, and three of them are not particularly pretty. So, you know, I can't be accused of being a naive optimist here. The first scenario is what I call regional fortresses. It kind of most resembles the status quo. We have North America, Europe, Northeast Asia. They don't want more migrants per se, not in terms of, you know, literally a quantum, you know, or quantum leap more than they presently take, but are seeking to obviously improve their own sustainability, but with minimal support to the rest of the world. So I organize the scenarios on the axes of migration and sustainability. So higher sustainability for us rich countries, but lower migration from poorer countries is what I call regional fortresses. Then there's two scenarios that are both relatively low migration and low sustainability, but high on volatility. The more localized one is what I call the New Middle Ages. It's kind of like hunter-gatherer, local scrambling, supply chains fall apart, you know, that kind of thing. You add in the other scenario, what I call barbarians at the gate. That's when you have uncontrolled migration, people, you know, sort of scrambling over borders and generally just mayhem and chaos and water wars and this kind of thing. And then you've got Northern Lights. Northern Lights is the fourth scenario, and it's the only one of the four that's positive, that's progressive, that speaks to this new model of civilization that I'm advocating. And Northern Lights implies a world in which we, A, do invest in a very high degree of sustainability, not only in domestically in rich countries in terms of renewable energy and more efficient water management and locally grown food, but we also export those technologies very actively to the entire world so that people stuck in places that are unlivable can still survive and thrive there. But we also have high migration because we find ways to peacefully recirculate people, to bridge these labor shortages, to move them to sustainable and livable habitats as climate change accelerates. And we therefore become more mobile and more circular at the same time. So Northern Lights is a scenario that points to, that kind of provides the roadmap to civilization 3.0, a mobile and sustainable system for organizing humanity. And it's not going to happen on a supranational level, COP26, the United Nations, the UN Security Council, not Biden, not Xi Jinping. No one entity is going to get us there because migration is not something that is multilaterally coordinated. And therefore, Canada becomes so important and the countries that are generous with migration become so important.
Prague and I continue our discussion on the role and importance of migrants in places like Germany and how they could change the political landscape in countries.
I'm glad you raised that. In Canada, we've made a commitment to well over 1% of the population as migrants or immigrants every year. Despite a bit of a setback during the COVID year, we're on for 410,000 migrants this year. And if you could just describe some of the attributes of countries that might, I know that there are no outright winners in this, just given the context, but just some of the countries that are doing a better job at this. And what do you think that they need to do to keep doing a better job at this, just given the ructions ahead, as you point to?
Well, let me just say Canada ranks 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you know, on that list. I, as you know, I have a great affinity for Canada, but not any, you know, legal or other kind of, you know, sort of background or connection to the country. So I write this as an objective analyst of immigration policy and what would constitute a contribution to this new human geography. And Canada absolutely punches way above its weight. So I hold it up, you know, very justifiably as the role model for other countries. And I organize countries into two categories, those that proactively get it and those that are going to learn the hard way and reluctantly. So Canada sits very high, you know, up and to the right in terms of countries that get it and are proactively seizing the opportunity, because you have the climate oasis geography, you have the labor shortages, you want to diversify your economy, you've built a political and cultural consensus around high migration, going back, of course, to the generation of the current prime minister's father. It's just part of the ether of Canadian identity. And that makes it easier, of course, to be a mass migration society, to set that target of more than 1% of your population every year, to become a great demographic power and again, an innovative and diversified economy through all the things you're doing. So then there's the reluctant countries that still deserve, you know, praise and honorable mentions, because other countries have very challenging identity politics and geographical circumstances and even geopolitical locations and conditions. So they need to look up to countries that are harder to emulate than Canada, or that are easier to emulate than Canada. And so I bring up Germany a lot in the book. As you know, I have a long history with Germany, living in and out of there for 30 plus years. And, you know, the Germany that I remember from the early 1990s was not nearly as polyglot and, with such a diverse complexion as it has today. And, you know, there was a famous German politician in the 90s who used this phrase, Kinder statt Inder, right? Which means have more babies, don't import Indians. And of course, if you look at India today, and I have this story, this anecdote, this sort of, you know, hypothetical dream sequence. I put my arm around this guy, Norbert Röttgen was his name. And I say, hey, Norbert, I got some news for you. You know, now take yourself back to 1991, right? In 30 years time, your country is going to have 5 million Turks, about 1 million Russians and former Soviet Republic citizens, 1 million people from the Balkans, a few hundred thousand Persians, 300,000 Chinese, about 100,000 Indians. Let's not forget the 1 million Africans who live in Germany. That's Germany in 30 years' time. Now, Norbert, old boy Norbert's going to have a heart attack right there on the spot. But welcome to Germany 2021. There you are, right? The engine of Europe, the only country with a growing labor force, one that just beat back the far right parties into, you know, sort of obsolescence, and has a center left coalition that's pro migration and asylum seekers. That's how you do it in a really tough country to do it in. I mean, I don't need to give a lecture right now about 20th century German identity politics, do I? Nor the origins of nationalist ideologies and 19th century like political thought. All of this is German. The fact that they are doing this is really important for other countries in Europe to see, because I can now go to all those other countries in Europe and scold them and say, Germany has done this, why haven't you? Right? And that's very important. Another couple of examples, though, that really matter, of course, Britain and the United States. You know, Britain has so botched immigration policy since Brexit and got hit with the double whammy of the pandemic. So shortages as people left after Brexit, shortages of truck drivers and nurses today because of COVID. And now they're desperately scrambling. I mean, Boris, the guy who backed Brexit, is now Mr. People Before Passports, right? It is legally easier today for a citizen of an underdeveloped country to migrate to the United Kingdom right now than in 2015, right now. That's how much Preeti Patel and gang have changed course, because they got religion. They woke up and said, oh my God, we don't have people, right? And then you can learn the hard way. And America also learned the hard way. Massive labor shortages. But now Biden is changing course. So countries learn the hard way or the easy way. Japan is an interesting example. Again, massive immigration reform announced at the beginning of this very week, in which, you know, even again, people who they thought of as just third world temporary construction workers are now being given permanent residency and right, you know, chain migration rights for their family. So the whole world is actually moving in the right direction. The notion that nationalism, populism, xenophobia are the driving political narratives of our time in terms of what we actually do, what our actual policies are, is literally a lie. And I go to great lengths in this book to deconstruct that lie. The countries that are led by authoritarian, populist, nationalist, strongmen are the same countries that everyone is leaving. Russia, Turkey, India, you name it, right? We conveniently omit that fact. We say the world is driven by these strongmen and identity politics is back. Yes, it's back. Everyone is leaving your country because of your identity politics, and they prefer places that are multi-ethnic and open and tolerant melting pots. Please include that half of the sentence, right, before you pretend that the world is run by these despotic zealots. And that's the real story of the world. Again, migration is who we are. Let me say one last point on this, a meta point that I know you'll appreciate. People, you know, see this book and the thesis, and they're like, oh my God, what kind of a dystopian future are we moving into? You know, so many people moving, mass migration, as if we haven't been there before. Rana, as a human civilization, as a constellation of political actors in the international system of the last centuries, we've been terrible at maintaining peace. We've been terrible at managing the global commons and the environment. We've been terrible at maintaining or promoting economic equity. What's the one thing we are good at? It's migration, mass migration, and absorbing migrants. It's literally a true statement. It's the one thing that we're best at. We're horrible at other things, despite the best efforts of great diplomats such as yourself. Here's the one thing we're so good at. So let's have confidence when we look to the future with mass migration upon us at an unprecedented scale, because we're actually really good at it. So let's do it.
With the rise of xenophobia and far-right movements across the globe, Prague and I talk about how countries that are welcoming of immigrants and migrants are the ones moving forward. Countries that are less welcoming are being left behind.
No, I get that point, and I, you know, largely sympathize with that point. And where does the cognitive dissonance really come from? Because we break this down, you seem to be positing a thesis around, it's almost a hydrodynamic thesis about human mobility in the sense that, or it's gravity driven in the sense that these are forces that are inextricable, versus the thesis that, you know, it's not just the certain governments in Europe and others around this idea of location centricity and the human nature element of needing to maintain community continuity versus an era of hypermobility, which clearly causes cognitive dissonance among some. And are we underpegging the amount of political effort and ruction that we are likely to see in the next decades as a result of some of the scenarios that you lay out?
There's no question that there are consequences, chain reactions, knock-on effects, negative feedback loops to poorly manage migration. It's the same thing goes for any single factor or variable that we choose to focus on and its implications for the other variables. But we do not live in a world where you can hold all things equal. You wiggle something here, it jiggles over there, as the famous saying goes. So, but when you say the cognitive dissonance, you're right, but I don't want to universalize it in the same way that I don't want people to think that, oh yes, we live in a world of populist nationalist xenophobia and therefore we are countering that. We do not. We live in a world of mass migrations where the smart countries successfully absorb those migrants and everyone else actually gets left behind. So we're already on the right track. So yes, there are disgruntled minorities that have either legitimate concerns or that simply are reflecting very parochial interests that are actually harm the system as a whole by way of their agenda. So for example, again, being anti-migration in the United States literally harms your workforce. You know, you have excess mortality due to COVID. Right, people who are anti-immigrant have blood on their hands because they didn't let in nurses, you know, and the kind of people who could be caregivers for vulnerable elderly people, right? Literally, and you know, by the way, I'll say this point blank. You know, if I talk to a far right person in Germany or somewhere, and I'll say, you know, why should we take more migrants? Do you know what I say to them, Rana? I said, because your mother and your father are going to die alone. I will point blank say that to people. So you are killing your parents because guess what? You don't live in that village in East Germany anymore. You've moved to Berlin. You've moved to Frankfurt. You've left them alone and you haven't let the Romanian or the Bulgarian or the Bangladeshi or the Filipino lady come in and take care and allow your own parents to have a dignified retirement and old age, because you were anti-migrant. So, you know, shame on you. Right. So that's when you say, yes, of course, there's cognitive dissonance. Of course, there's dislocation. I have great sympathy for the people who say I grew up in a, you know, maybe monochrome, but safe and stable Western European country. Why are these Afghans here, you know, driving their cars through the Christmas market or, you know, harassing my women? Right. That has happened. And I think it's wrong. And I'm for, there's something called assimilation policy. That's where social spending, that's where investment should go, right? How do you help people adapt to the local norms and civic identity? And that's what's happening in a lot of countries. If you look at Sweden, there's a lot of critique of Sweden, but they've definitely had, you know, rising crime and violence. So they're saying, look, here's the deal. You know, you come from Syria, you come from Afghanistan, you come from Iraq, you know, you can stay, but you're going to go to high school, you're going to finish school, you're going to learn Swedish, you're going to get a job, subsidies are going to, you know, be tapered and wind down, you're going to be a law-abiding member of this society, and you're going to get a passport, play by the rules. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. I am not the bleeding heart liberal who says, let us have 1,000 enclaves of parallel justice in your country. You have a right as a democratic society to define what your national laws are. I hope that those are secular values that other people can adopt and converge with rather than being totally culturally exclusive. That is something that I would like to, you know, maintain such that people have a hope that they can have a German civic identity without being Protestant, right? But that's exactly what Germany is saying. They have a whole discourse called Die Neuen Deutschen, the new Germans. What does it mean to be German? And the answer is not you must be Christian, you know, or have a certain, you know, ethnic heritage. Not at all. They're saying, what are the broader civic values that we identify with our country, our state, not our tribal nation, our state? And people who want to be part of that are going to be allowed to be part of it. They're going to be celebrated. Look at the composition of the new German Parliament. I mean, you would think you were in Canada, Rana. I mean, on a relative basis, how far they have evolved in terms of, you've got Vietnamese and Africans and Arabs and, you know, Asians, all manner of ethnic minorities who are at the highest levels of politics. It's phenomenal. So that's where we're going. That's where we have been going. And that's a good thing. And we just need to deal everyone into the story.
Prague talks more about how young people are shaping the world and how this book really zooms in on people under 40. I wanted to know more about how much talent is migrating and circulating these days.
I'm in Silicon Valley, and I spend a lot of my time thinking about the way in which talent crosses not just borders, but circulates in this century, and particularly now, either accelerated through pandemic, but also as a result of a variety of trends and technologies that are out there. We think a lot about the way in which talent is moving right now. And I wonder if you had some reflections in terms of particularly the kind of what I would call sort of catalytic talent, or the folks who would be the stem cells for the creation of the next industrial base for a lot of the countries, in our case, Canada.
Very well put, Rana. And, you know, it is a golden age for young talent. Canada is pound for pound the winner, you know, in a way, not displacing, but certainly neck and neck with the United States. All surveys of professionals around the world that have been done the last couple of years have now put Canada as the most desirable destination, even ahead of the United States. But look, there's plenty of talent to go around, so let it spread. Germany's trying, Britain is trying, Japan is capturing talent. You know, there's a lot more livable expat hubs or global hubs than there were 10 years ago, which is a good thing. So you want people to have choice. Remote work is also giving people choice. But if you want to think about your demographic health and vitality, you do need to attract people physically onto your soil, because they become taxpayers and they, you know, put their children in schools and you know, they contribute to the societal ecosystem, not just to the corporate supply chain, you know, an ecosystem. So there is both going on. So yes, tech is mobile. Tech doesn't have to. I mean, you almost want to take advantage of the fact that tech is diversifying. I mean, you've done a great job with this. You build those networks with Silicon Valley companies and have them expand their operations and tap Canadian talent, also even relocate to Canada and so forth. So it is a very competitive world. People think not because everything is in the cloud, you know, Web3 is going to be everything. You also want to be the most attractive physical geographic place in a world where young people, and my story, I mean, this book is absolutely about the younger 4 billion people of the world. This is extremely important, you know, to point out that 60% of the world population is young, not old. So if you want to write about the future, like as we said at the beginning, this is a book about the world of 2050. Well, guess what? Therefore, it's a book about everyone who today is under 40. So for me, they are the protagonists, the heroes, millennials, Gen Z, Gen Alpha. That's who this is about. Treating them as a subject, not an object. What are they thinking about? Where do they want to be? What do they find attractive? What are their values and priorities and norms? And which system, what society best reflects them? So people wanting to go to Canada is not just a statement about, hey, you know, Waterloo is rising the rankings, you know, of universities. It's about saying this is a society that represents the values of 5 billion young people in the world. And yes, I do feel that you can actually generalize about them, because guess what? This is the most surveyed and psychoanalyzed group of people in the history of humanity, right? We mine their Facebook accounts and Instagram and everything. So we know a lot about how young people think, and I like how they think. I like the fact that they're geographically mercenary. That they say, you know what? I'm going to vote with my feet. I'm going to vote with my wallet. I'm going to vote with my sentiment online, with my clicks. And I'm going to physically or digitally go to places that reflect my values. And so places have to be accommodating of those values. They want affordable housing. They want a liberal culture. You know, they believe in mobility. They believe in sustainability. They believe in connectivity. They believe all of these things are human rights. And the world, our institutions, political, economic, social, have to literally redesign ourselves around those values. And those that don't will lose. And I want them to lose, and I want them to learn the hard way if they have to, but I want the winners to prosper. And I want those places to be the open places that attract and gain the talent without a moment's delay, because we have this broader mission to recirculate the world population, to allow young people to thrive today, not for them to wait. When we look at tragic geographies like the Arab world and we look at the youth bulge, well, Rana, I mean, 9/11 was 20 years ago. I started working on reports at Brookings and think tanks 20 years ago about the disenfranchised, marginalized Arab youth bulge and how this is a ticking time bomb. How many of those people have gotten to migrate and had their opportunities improve since the time they were 10 to 20, 25 years old when we were writing about them? Now they're 30 and 40 and 50 years old. And guess what? We've wasted a generation by not allowing them to vote with their feet. And that is inexcusable to me. And I don't want the next generation to suffer that fate. So I want the countries that are doing it right to open themselves up, to embrace that, you know, to be the winners in the war for talent, and everyone else to learn the hard way if they have to, that they need to up their game. And you only get to that outcome if you let young people vote with their feet.
To conclude our discussion, we focus on Web 3.0, a decentralized internet built on cryptographic technologies, and where Prague sees the internet and the world heading in the future. We also touch on how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted his book, both before and after.
I'm going to ask the most Silicon Valley question towards the end here, and it's about Web 3. The new poll that his world, the Web 3.0, distributed, some would say crypto, both substrated on crypto, but also a philosophy that goes along with that around the way that new communities, particularly in this distributed way, are going to organize themselves. How would you integrate that thesis and that position in the work that you're doing right now?
Very, very strongly. Look out for an essay that he and I are just finishing right now on exactly this topic, you know, around kind of what Web3 means for geopolitics and the war for talent, because it's deeply interconnected. Because the notion that the world is moving into a nationally siloed set of splinter nets, and therefore people have to make this sort of, you know, firm and finite permanent choice, is a myth when you think about the future architecture of the internet and the competitive dynamics between that cloud-based global architecture of free choice and association and encryption and cloud communities, which allows you to be more geographically, again, you know, remote and virtual and choose your location, really, you know, sort of betrays that conventional narrative. So I think that's going to be very important. And again, the societies that are pushing on that open door of Web3, of crypto, of enabling this process to unfold and seizing it and gaining the talent as a result of supporting rather than opposing that process are going to be the winning societies.
Finally, you wrote this book principally before lockdown and before the pandemic was with us. What would you change if you were to write this book right now, just given your travels and everything you've learned since?
Well, I actually had the entire pandemic to revise it. So I did. I don't have to. I made the changes. You know, the pandemic, again, you know, most paradoxical moment to be revising the book because, of course, we didn't know when the lockdown would end. But I was certain that the pandemic, as in past pandemics, would be a driver of more migration because people would say, I don't want to be stuck in this red zone, or I don't want to be in a dense urban place when I can be a remote worker in a more scenic, you know, green pasture, and so on and so forth. So I was pretty sure that it would wind up promoting greater migration. And again, it intersects with all of those other mega trends, right? I knew that the world wouldn't be trapped down in place simply because of one lockdown, even as profound as it was, precisely because all those other forces. I mean, the pandemic didn't end climate change. It didn't end political volatility. It didn't end economic crises. It didn't end technological disruptions. All of those things, plus climate change, are going to continue to drive us to move. The pandemic isn't going to stop it. The pandemic would actually accelerate it because you now have the excess mortality and the labor shortages and all of these other things. So it feeds into this much broader, complex set of drivers. And again, you know, the winners and losers are simultaneously, you know, geographic and technological and demographic groups. And I wanted to, you know, as you asked at the beginning, just to kind of come full circle, to put humans at the center, the finite number of agents, of individuals, especially young people, and where they go and giving them those opportunities and letting it almost organically sort itself out, in not in an uncontrolled borderless way, but in a structured way, that is how we are going to advance as a civilization.
Well, that's a terrific place to stop. You've been very generous with your time, and Parag Khanna, from the life and times of the Cosmocracy to the Second World, through so many other books that you've produced over the years, and your advocacy and your ability to see beyond the trend has always been terrific. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir. That was great fun.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you were able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. With global changes like the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change, many people have migrated further away from cities. The pandemic has also increased mobility with the rise of remote work. Humans have always migrated. Today, countries are adapting to increased internal and external migration, which poses challenges along with opportunities on a global scale. We're in a war for talent. In order to attract more young talent, countries must consider what a new generation wants, from affordable housing to climate action. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Parag Khanna for being my guest. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yves Beaulieu, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Kanika Codrington. I'm Rana Sarkar. Thank you for listening. Until next time.